From a not-so-sweltering as last week, Capital City, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 21 for Friday the 15th of April, 2011. On the show this week...
When we think about our market opportunity, we think about the fact that there's 5 billion phones in the world today, there's probably 2 billion PCs. So it's 2.5 times the size, and we're really focused on that going to 6 billion by the end of 2012.
Popular music discovery service Shazam has been busy in the United States, moving its business from letting you find out what that song is playing in the club to the world of television advertising. But Shazam's a British company, so what's next for us? We sit down with the company CEO Andrew Fisher to find out. That's all coming up after we plummet into this week's river of Wired news. Hello, I'm Nate Langson, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me in Wired's intellectual ball pool this week is news editor Bolivia underscore Solon.
Hi.
Hi. How are you, Liv?
I'm good, thanks. I'm good.
Do you see what I did there, by the way?
I do see what you did. You've done a nice little segue into our first story.
I like to call it a pre-segue. Bolivia has instigated or proposed a law that gives nature the same right as humans.
Yeah, that's right. It's called La Ley de Derechos de la Madre Tierra, which is the law of Mother Earth.
Ooh, ooh. Say that again.
La Ley de Derechos de la Madre Tierra, which is the law of Mother Earth. And the idea is to kind of encourage a really big shift in attitudes towards the environment and to reduce pollution, because Bolivia has suffered quite a lot through climate change. Their temperatures have risen quite a lot. Their glaciers are melting, mm-hmm. And their crops are failing. So they've put this law in place. I think they actually passed it on the 8th of December. But they haven't really implemented it properly. They're looking to appoint a minister of Mother Earth.
So let me get this right. This is essentially giving a tree the same rights to not breathe in, say, car fumes as a human being.
I mean, it's sort of like that. It's not that we're saying, a tree can't be attacked by a tree-eating insect or something like that.
Yeah, you're not going to go and arrest a bush.
It's more just saying that there's new rights for nature, including the right to life, the right to water and clean air, the right to repair livelihoods affected by human activities, and the right to be free of pollution. So obviously, this could, potential violators could be big businesses who are, maybe doing mining business or kind of deforestation. And this is going to be a bit of a problem for Bolivia because a lot of their business, their GDP comes from mining. So I'm not quite sure how they're going to balance it.
But it's not in the same way that, I suppose, if you take one axe to one man with human rights, you're probably going to jail. But yeah. One axe to a tree isn't going to cause any problems here. It's more for 10,000 men with 10,000 axes taking, those to a tree.
Exactly.
That sort of thing.
I mean, what they haven't made clear is how this is going to work in practice, because obviously the tree cannot go to the police and file a complaint. It has to be local communities have to flag up irresponsible activity.
Of course, because a tree can't say, "I'm being wronged," in the same way a human can.
Exactly. So I'm not quite. They haven't explained how it's going to be implemented, but it'll be really interesting to see how it pans out.
Yeah, very much so. Well. What's been panning out in other news is Spotify, for anyone who's been using the free streaming service, has changed its policy on how much you can stream for free every month. Quite a while ago, Spotify stopped letting users stream as much music as they wanted for free and said you can only listen to 20 hours a month, and after that you have to pay. It's now basically has announced that it's going to be changing that 20-hour limit to 10 hours a month. But I think more importantly is that it's also restricting the number of plays of single songs to 5. So you can listen to a song 5 times ever on Spotify for free. And after that, you can never listen to it again.
So unless you upgrade.
Unless you upgrade. So you'll get a fresh 10 hours of free streaming every month, supported by ads. But if you listen to one song 5 times, that's it. And the thing is, I can see why this is going to annoy a lot of free users, but in a way, I kind of see what they're doing here and it makes sense. Because if a lot of people treat Spotify as a music discovery tool or they're sampling something a friend has recommended, and 10 hours a month and playing a song 5 times will give you enough time to decide whether or not you like that song, whether you want to buy it. If you listen to it 5 times in a month, then maybe you want to go and buy that song. You want to listen to it a lot. And if you want to listen to it continually on Spotify, you pay £5 a month or £10 a month or whatever you, you know, whichever Spotify plan you want to go for. So playing devil's advocate, I think that what this does is it makes Spotify distinctly two different products. For a free product, it's making it a sampling service supported by ads, which doesn't pay a lot of money. And on the other side, it's a subscription service that lets you stream as much as you want on Android and on iPhone and on your desktop computer for, you know, the cost of a CD. So I don't know. I'm ambivalent. I really am.
I think a lot of people do use it as their jukebox, even if it is ad-supported. And I think what I see as a potential alternative model would be to really drive the free users, drive the repetitive playing of different songs and just upping the ad rate and then giving the labels some kind of revenue share from the advertising. And in that case, you want to increase your audience and increase the plays as much as possible.
But they are doing, aren't they? Because, I mean, the record label get a cut of the ad revenue. You know, that's basically how Spotify pays for the streaming that its users do on its service.
But in which case, the more users you have and the more plays you have, the more money you'll get. So it seems, you know, a bit silly to be curtailing that by instigating this limitation.
It's true, but one of Spotify's claims is that the 10-hour restriction is only going to be affecting heavy users.
Yeah.
So it's only affecting the people that are basically using the service as an alternative to paying for, you know, their main jukebox application, if you like.
Yeah.
And again I kind of think that's probably right. I mean, 10 hours a month is way more than I would ever use if I was using Spotify to sample music people recommend to me. But if I wanted to listen to all my albums, I'm listening to probably 6, 7, 8 hours of music a day.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go over that limit straight away. It's one of the reasons I don't use Spotify, by the way. So interested to hear anyone's thoughts who has been using Spotify for free for the last however long it's been around for, a few years. Drop us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk. We'll read some opinions out next week. Liv, let's talk about pilots in space, shall we?
Let's indeed. I mean, there's a new job ad that's gone up for a rather important role with Virgin Galactic for a pilot astronaut.
Yeah, now this is Virgin Galactic. We talked about Virgin Oceanic last week, where Virgin's taking one-man submarines to the deepest points of Earth's oceans. Now we're talking about its space tourism business. I have to say, pretty interesting company at the moment, I suppose. But anyway, yeah, they've put up an advert on their site for a pilot astronaut, which is essentially someone who's going to be flying their commercial space flights into space.
Yeah, and before everyone gets really overexcited about their childhood dreams of being an astronaut, it's not that easy to apply, is it?
Amusingly, they said that previous space piloting would be advantageous, or words to that effect. But the actual qualifications for the job are really, as you say, quite restrictive. So, I mean, firstly, you've got to be a US citizen, so that puts me and you out. I know how much you want to be flying planes into the space.
My eyesight's not good enough. I think I'll probably need 20/20 vision.
Well, just get a pilot's license now, and then when they start doing ones to Mars, you can apply.
Excellent.
I mean, don't, because I like you being our news editor, so thanks. But you need to be a US citizen, and you need a pilot's license. That's probably quite obvious. A degree level qualification in a relevant technical field. A graduate of a recognized test pilot school with 2.5 years of postgrad flight experience. You need about a minimum of 3,000 hours of flying background on a diverse range of aircraft. So just piloting a small plane from, you know, America, somewhere in America to somewhere very close also in America isn't going to be good enough. You need operational experience of an aerospace aviation project or business. So, I mean, really what this seems to me is, oh, and a proven team player. I mean, that's a given, I suppose, if you can be flying a spacecraft. But what this says to me, I mean, it sounds really restrictive, but there are probably quite a lot of people at NASA who have maybe joined NASA's, you know, many space projects or, you know, the shuttle program or things like that, who came from a experienced piloting background, who are probably quite suitable for this job.
Yeah, I think it's probably quite a good thing that they've got pretty strict application criteria.
Yeah, definitely. But so if anyone's listening who wants to become a space pilot, then go and speak to Virgin. No idea how much it pays. We did email Virgin to find out if we could get a salary guideline. And all we could really interpret is that it's above the national minimum wage. But apart from that, we don't know yet.
Probably about £7 an hour.
Yeah, at least. Well, the minimum wage in the UK has just gone up, actually. So if they start hiring UK people, then it's going to be at least about £6, £8 an hour.
Big, Big time.
Very much so. In other sort of plane news, Liv, tell me about this plane that was gunned down in 1940 that for some reason is on our site.
Yeah, well, it was a German, initially a German mail and cargo plane that later became a bomber during the Second World War that has been found in the English Channel. It was first found in 2008, mm-hmm. But the Port of London Authority has taken sonar equipment to get some really amazing images of the plane under the sea near the coast of Kent.
And the plane's actually been kept completely or almost completely intact by the sand, right?
Yeah, which is quite unusual. I mean, normally the tides would bash something like this apart, but the plane is in very, very good condition. Even some of the tires on the wheels are still inflated, so they've got these incredible images, and they're really keen to pull this plane out of the sea. Unfortunately, some people are going and taking parts of the plane home, like looters and souvenir hunters, so they're trying to get it out so they can put it in a Battle of Britain event.
But there's a photograph on the website, and actually if you're looking at this on an iPod or on your computer or something, this MP3, this podcast, yeah, that you are listening to, the album art, you should have a look at, because we've included a photo in there of this plane. I mean, it's kind of amazing to think that, you know, 70 years ago, a plane was shot down and that didn't destroy it. And then being under the sea for 70 years didn't destroy it. And its tires are still inflated.
Yeah,
I mean, these guys can really build planes.
Yeah. And for plane buffs, it's a Dornier 17 for anyone who knows their planes.
Well, from taking planes down to taking prices down, and thanks very much, Liv, for that segue. That was really good. Amazon has announced in the US that its Kindle, which is its ebook reader, is going to be coming in an ad-supported flavor, or
Kindle with special offers?
Yeah, I was trying to think of a different way of putting it. But basically, yeah, it's you get $25 off the cost of the device, which is, I think, $139 full price. So you're going to get it for about $114 or something like that. Anyway, it's a very small amount of the price to let Amazon run ads on the Kindle. So like when it's in sleep mode, you're going to see ads for products and books, I think.
Yeah, it's just kind of screensavers and some kind of skyscraper or banners around the text, correct?
Yeah, that's right. And it's going to go on sale on Amazon.com on the 3rd of May. And it makes me wonder what the advantage is in saving $25 to have an ebook reader full of ads. That's not actually a big saving,
yeah,
at all.
Well,
you could buy a second hand one.
If you're going to have an ad supported model, you've got to bring the price down significantly, more so than you could get in a discount store or something like that. I mean, you need to have it very, very cheap in order for people to put up with this, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's more interesting, I think, when you think about what Amazon could be doing with the Kindle to sort of make the physical hardware cheaper. This is one way, which seems to me to be a bit rubbish, if I'm absolutely honest. Or crap, if I'm even more honest. But why not, and we've said this on the podcast before, I think, the idea of having the hardware be free or extremely cheap in the same way that mobile phones are,
yeah,
and sell it with some sort of a contract, you know, a couple of years where you pay a very small amount a month, get a couple of ebooks as part of that subscription a month, a bit like Audible does with audiobooks, in fact, which Amazon owns.
Yeah.
Amazon owns Audible, doesn't it? And make the device itself almost free or as close to free as possible.
Yeah.
Which just to me would be so much more attractive than just $25, which is about £15 off the cost of a £100 device.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem very attractive at all.
Or maybe having a sliding scale of prices based on how much advertising you get exposed to. And, you know, you could get it super cheap, but you have, you know, got interrupted every, you know, chapter or something.
Yeah. Unfortunately as well, if anyone is interested in taking up this offer, and honestly, please do let me know if you are, because I don't know anyone yet who said they are, it's only going to be available in the US.
Yeah,
so
bummer.
We sent an email to Amazon and they said, nope, no UK yet. But to be honest, Amazon tends to do this. They start things off in America, and if it works and they like it, then they bring it over to the UK next, yeah, Germany and maybe France, and then everywhere else after that. So,
but I don't think it's the idea of having advertising that's the deterrent. It's just the fact that it's not reducing the price by enough.
No, it's not. It's reducing it by the cost of a couple of books,
yeah,
over the lifetime of the device, which just seems rubbish. But let us know what you think anyway, podcast@wired.co.uk. Before we move on to our feature this week, a couple of sort of quick little bits of news. Cisco, which you may know makes routers, or most likely don't know makes routers, bought those little flip cameras a couple of years ago, bought the company Flip, and did very little with it, even though it was an incredibly popular line of products, and they've just killed it. So Flip is now dead.
Yeah.
Liv, we were talking about this just before the show, and we reckon it's basically because mobile phones have got to such a level with video recording capabilities and with built-in networking and sharing that the Flip just became redundant.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Flip was the top-selling product on Amazon for I think, more than a year. And I think that was the point when Cisco bought it for just $590 million. And I think, you know, the one thing you don't get with camera phones is the little editing. They had really simple editing software that you get with Flip, which made it really easy to cut and paste different scenes. But I just don't think people were using it enough.
No. I mean, Cisco, you know, the business is needing to look active in, you know, cost cutting and getting profits up and things like that. And so this was probably a wise business decision to kill it, even though, you know, shareholders probably aren't necessarily impressed with the amount they acquired for it so soon ago.
But it'd be interesting to find out how much money they made during the time that they owned it, because it was a successful business when they bought it, and it might have just been that they've cut it off very quickly in order to cut their losses.
You know what? It's absolutely right. The thing is, by killing it now, because they haven't invested in it, they've seen where its future's going, and it's probably nowhere because phones are taking over. It's like, well, let's stop this thing tanking. Yeah. Cut it off, save some money. It'll probably involve some job losses, which is a big shame. But for the business, they have to be brutal. And this probably makes a lot of sense in the big picture.
And they might use some of the skills that they've acquired from people working in the product design on their telepresence stuff that they're working on. They're really trying to push into home telepresence systems. And this potentially could have brought in some good skills to the business.
That's actually a really good point. A lot of business acquisitions are to get either intellectual property and patents or basically talent.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of companies get bought by other companies just for their people. They shut the product down very soon afterwards and then incorporate those people into their existing product line.
And the distribution network that they have as well, because they never really had that many consumer-facing products.
No, I mean, so much of the internet is basically built on Cisco routers.
Yes.
But no one
the
necessarily
plumbers
knows.
Of the internet.
Exactly. So, bit of a shame, though, for Flip, because it's obviously, you know, such a good line back in the day.
Yeah.
Bit of a shame
I
to
love
see
my
go.
Flip camera.
And very finally, in the quickest bit of news, I just wanted to point out that one of my favourite series, TV series of all time, Red Dwarf, has just been confirmed to be getting a 10th series. Woo!
Yay.
They're going to start filming it at the end of this year, so it's probably going to be out on Dave, the channel Dave, probably spring or something next year. And on that incredibly thrilling note, we are going to move on to our feature this week and invite Shazam CEO Andrew Fisher to tell us what's going on with Shazam and what's coming next. I'm here with Andrew Fisher, who's the CEO of Shazam. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So before we get into what's next, can you give a little outline of what Shazam is and how it works?
Well, most people know Shazam as a music identification application on mobile phones, which means that you just simply point your phone at the music and we tell you what's playing. And then from there, you can go on and buy the track, or you can share the experience with your friends on Facebook or Twitter, or you can link through to music stores or other music accounts like Spotify and Pandora Last FM.
So this is a service that basically has a database of songs that can be matched to a recording that you make in a bar and let you know what that song is if you don't know what it is.
Yes, we have over 10 million songs on the database. The service is live in 200 countries around the world. And one of the things that's unique about Shazam is that when people are in a nightclub, for example, often they'll try and tag a song that may not have even been signed to a record label at that point in time. So we work very hard to get the music onto our database, and therefore when people use Shazam, it just works and we come back with a positive result.
So with all this innovation going on in mobile, I guess the most interesting question is, where's it going next? What's next for Shazam?
Yes, well, thank you for asking. I mean, the first thing is that at the end of 2010, we passed a milestone in the company, which was that we exceeded 100 million users around the world, and we're running at 1 million new users every single week now. So we've just passed another milestone of 120 million users. So the first thing is to make sure that we encourage people to come back to Shazam. With so many applications on people's phones today, one thing to focus on is encouraging people to come back to your application and showing them value. And we're doing that by continuing to invest in music. But we're also pivoting the business now and encouraging people to use Shazam to interact with television shows and television advertising. And I would stress that right now we're focusing on the North American market, so don't go out and try this in the UK just at the moment. But it's been very, very successful. We launched at the Super Bowl a year ago with Levi's. And people could Shazam the television advert, and then they'd get a promotion to enter a prize draw. Levi's gave away 5,000 pairs of jeans. But over the past 6 months, we've been working with most of the broadcasters in North America, so people like NBC Universal, Discovery Channel. And what users see is the Shazam logo actually presented on screen during the television show. And then if they bring out their mobile phone, they can Shazam the show, and there'll be a follow-on experience thereafter. So they can see exclusive video, they can share it immediately with their friends on Facebook, tell their friends which show they're watching, on Twitter as well.
So is it a bit like a glorified QR code or something like that?
Well, I wouldn't call it a glorified QR code, but yeah, it's very, very simple. It's exactly the same application on the phone, and you just simply point your mobile phone towards the television set, and then you'll get some kind of experience happening on the phone or any device that has a microphone. It works on the iPad and other devices as well.
Ah, so it's still doing it based on audio. It's not image recognition. You're not recognizing the Shazam logo.
No, it's literally we just take the show onto our database and we treat it like a piece of music. So a 60-minute show, a two-hour-long film, it's just treated as a piece of music.
I see. And where can that be taken next? What's the next logical step for that to go?
Well, the key thing for us is to connect the buyer and seller. I mean, that's one of our missions, and what we're focused on as a company is to make it more convenient for people to buy products and services that they're interested in. And so we're focusing right now on the actual advertising on television. We've got a very large campaign running with Old Navy that's been very successful. It's a six-month campaign. It's over $40 million in value. And we've had a very, very high uptake rate. So people can Shazam the advert itself. They can buy the clothes. Old Navy is part of the Gap Group, so they can buy the clothes immediately on their device. They're also giving away the song that's used in the advert. And then there's a number of other things like sweepstakes and prize draws that people can participate in.
So it's quite different to the traditional idea of, I like this song, what is this song, iPhone out, tag, discover, buy on iTunes, which has traditionally been your model. This seems like quite a shift away from your core business. Would you say that's right?
Well, the music part for us ultimately was about connecting the buyer and seller of music. So it's not that much of a significant shift. I think most people think of Shazam as a discovery tool, but really the sell-through rates are incredibly high. We have a 10% conversion to purchase. So 1 in 10 songs that people identify on Shazam are actually purchased. And we're one of the most successful merchants on a mobile platform for music around the world. But people probably don't identify with that. I mean, it's more the magic of getting the result back than it is actually buying the product. But at the end of the day, Shazam is about convenience. It's about a single click to purchase. So ultimately, you'll be able to instruct Shazam in your profile that when I use the service, I want to buy the product. And that saves you going to the internet, opening up a browser, going through a merchant store, getting into the payment system. It doesn't get any simpler than a sub 5 second experience to buy a product.
Definitely. And you've got the advantage that your company name is a verb. You know, we Shazam stuff. I mean, companies would kill for that in many ways.
Well, you know, building a global brand can only be done cost-effectively through virality, and you have to build a magical experience and get people to tell their friends about your application or your service. And I think the company's executed really well on that. It's taken them a long time. A lot of people don't appreciate that Shazam has been around almost for 8 years now in the market. So it took us a long time to build awareness and get people using the service. But we have had an inflection point in the company since the smartphone and the App Store revolution, and that's where we've got this incredible trajectory now towards 250 million users, which is what we're focused on.
And when do you think you'll achieve that?
That's a good question. We've been right on our 50 million and 100 million user targets. At a million a week, we still think we're probably about at least 12 to 15 months away from that objective. But since last September, every single week, 1 million new users have come to Shazam, and that is actually increasing week on week now.
A lot of tech companies are seeing China as being the next big place to crack in terms of business. Are you doing much in the Chinese market? Have you got eyes set on China for the next cycle for Shazam at all?
Actually, China is one of our biggest markets, but it's not the primary focus for the company. So what we've done is we've continued to invest in what we call mid-tier phones. That means they're not the smartphones with touchscreens and lots of features. They are very simple phones with limited feature set in Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, India, and parts of China. And that's a long-term commitment for us. We want to get people using Shazam and encouraging them to become aware of the service. But the main markets for us are places like North America, Western Europe, where you do have high penetration of smartphones. We've just passed 1/3 of all devices last week in North America are now a smartphone. And you can do so much on those particular devices. We are focused on making money, but we're also focused on the ultimate goal of the company, which is to become ubiquitous worldwide. And when we think about our market opportunity, we think about the fact that there's 5 billion phones in the world today. There's probably 2 billion PCs. So it's 2.5 times the size, and we're really focused on that going to 6 billion by the end of 2012. And when you think about our 120 million users, it's only just over 2% of the opportunity. So we have a long way to go in the company, but we're very optimistic about where we can end up. And China and some of these other territories around the world are important if your ultimate goal is to become ubiquitous.
I agree. And I suppose that's why, I mean, my last question was going to be, you're a British company. Why is America getting the next evolution of Shazam before us here in the United Kingdom?
I think the truth of that actually is to do with the red button. The red button does exist in the UK. It doesn't exist in North America. And so we've been slightly led by that aspect. But it won't be too long before we actually bring this to the UK. The key thing for us is that...
Have you got a time frame?
We don't have a specific time frame. The key thing for us is that actually connecting the first and second screen or two devices together with a mobility factor is more valuable than the red button interaction. So that means that you can then take a voucher or redeem an offer in the high street in the UK. You can participate in something that has a location associated with it. So ultimately, we think this is going to be a very successful service in the UK, but it was a very simple decision that we went to North America because there was no interactivity there.
Andrew Fisher, thank you ever so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrew. And on that note, we're going to wrap up the show this week. We should point out, which we didn't at the beginning of the show, Duncan isn't with us because he's walking the highlands of Scotland getting bitten by ticks.
Yeah, I know. He might be enraged, though, by some of the Spotify news that he's not able to be involved in this conversation.
He is a giant Spotty fan.
Yeah, he is.
And not a Spotty fan. You know what I mean. Duncan will be back next week, no doubt to regale us with tales of what happens in the highlands of Scotland with no mobile phone access.
Indeed.
Until then, you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Wired UK. I am at Nate Langson, and Liv is
Olivia_Solon.
There it is. And also, interesting bit of news, we are now facebook.com/WiredUK, not UK Wired. So
it's an exciting time.
That is the level of Thursday excitement, changing our Facebook URL, finally. So go and give us a like on there. And Liv, tell everyone how they can email us.
You can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
You can and should. We will see you next week.
Goodbye.
Thank you, Andrew, and that sounded a bit patronizing, didn't it?